Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. When it comes to discussing the unfortunate politics involved in the climate change crisis confronting our planet, there's nobody I can think of better suited to talk about it than Dr. Michael Mann, the distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University. He won the prestigious Tyler Prize for the Environmental Sciences in 2019, and in 2020 was named to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. His latest book, The New Climate War, is a tour de force that examines the decades-long campaigns of disinformation, dissembling, and deflection led not just by the fossil fuel industry, but also by the political powers that profit from them while plunging our fragile planetary climate system ever deeper into existential peril. The back cover features the usual praise blurbs, but it's a veritable who's who of climate activists, including Greta Thunberg, Leonardo DiCaprio, Bill McKibben, Al Gore, and Don Cheadle. Not coincidentally, all of them have been attacked by the forces that Dr. Mann discusses in the book, and he explains why they do it. So if you feel guilty about not quite recycling enough, flying too much, or eating meat, you might want to listen to our discussion to find out why you've been set up to feel that way. It's more complicated than you might think. So let's get to my interview with climate scientist and author of The New Climate War, Dr. Michael Mann. Welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Thanks, Dave. It's good to be with you.
How many books have you written now?
This is technically number five, I guess. Four books for grown-ups and one children's book that I co-authored a couple years ago.
Right. And can you just, what was the genesis in your mind that made you want to write this particular book?
Yeah, well, you know, it's the way sort of I go about writing books, I have to wait until I feel like there's something, you know, that I want to say. And, I would say, you know, about a year and a half ago, sort of, I felt like, you know, there's a new chapter in this unfolding drama, which is the climate crisis and our efforts or lack of efforts, frankly, to deal with it. And I just felt like there were a number of new threads that have come together to sort of paint a somewhat different picture as we sort of evolve out of denialism. Climate change denial is on the wane because it's just not credible anymore. And, you know, in Northern California, as you know, as those of us back east who have witnessed this record hurricane season know, the impacts are no longer subtle. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. They've become very clear. They unfold in real time. And so denial isn't credible anymore, but the forces of inaction, I call them the inactivists in the book, that is fossil fuel interests and those doing their bidding who don't want to see us basically transition off our addiction to fossil fuels. As denial no longer becomes credible, they've turned to a new set of tactics in their efforts to block or at least blunt this transition away from fossil fuels. It's what I call the new climate war, and it consists of a variety of tactics that I go into great detail about, of course, in the book. But
okay, so after reading this book, and it's an excellent book, I really enjoyed it. There are a few things that struck me about it, and one of the things was I was thinking about people that I know that live in this area, yeah, that have never been on board with my point of view on climate change. And I came to this understanding in the 1980s while I was a student studying planetary science and planetary atmospheres in particular, yeah, under an excellent astronomy professor named James Regas, yeah, at California State University, Chico. And his expertise was in the atmosphere of Venus. So, you know, we were doing a lot of detailed modeling and investigations of the runaway greenhouse effect on Venus. So for years, I've been, you know, trying to talk to people around me about this. And I've noticed this interesting evolution and not really understanding it fully until I read your book. So I'll give you, you know, a typical one of these people in my life. And they're nice people. They're not completely stupid or anything like that. But they've gone from arguing with me about that they don't think that climate change is a real thing, that they're, you know, this is a, these are artifacts of temperature and all these different arguments. It's the sun, you know, this, that, and the other thing, that it, that it's not the carbon dioxide, that we're, you know, oh, maybe it is warming, but we're not causing it. To now they no longer will argue with me about that. But they kind of just say, well, we, you know, our economy can't handle, you know, going to this crazy Green New Deal, or hey, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, what are we going to do about it anyway? So I'm not going to worry about it. So I've seen that unfold, and your book has helped me understand that. So I'd like to kind of go through this with you. Take us back to the beginning, if you will, when the scientists and oil companies began to understand this was a real problem way back in the beginning. This is not a new thing. There has been an understanding that putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere was going to have long-term and dramatic consequences for the Earth's climate system quite a long time ago. Could you kind of take us through that early period?
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, I talk about a memo. In fact, I start out with that from, you know, you're told, you know, it's a memo. You read it, you would think, you know, maybe it was Al Gore, but no, it was ExxonMobil. Back in the early 1980s, it was an internal memo that ultimately was buried by them. They had a research team that had been studying the potential consequences of increasing carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere from fossil fuel burning. And ExxonMobil's own scientists referred to the potential impacts as, or the impacts as being potentially catastrophic. And so it's an internal memo from ExxonMobil. And what's remarkable is that their scientists also made a prediction about the future path of carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere and the warming that would result. And they got it, you know, the head of the you know, hit the nail on the head in their estimate. They successfully predicted where we are right now, how much CO2 has increased and the warming that has resulted from that. And what's so remarkable about that prediction is to predict the CO2 concentration, they in essence had to predict that they would be successful, that ExxonMobil's own lobbyists and PR flax and the fossil fuel industry would be successful in blocking any efforts to transition off our burning of fossil fuels. So they were able to predict both the success of their efforts to prevent action and the warming of the planet that would result. And so I love to point to that when, you know, people, if they say, well, you know, I don't trust these scientists. They've got an agenda. It's like, well, let's look at ExxonMobil's predictions from back in the early 1980s, because they saw this themselves and they recognized that the impact could indeed be catastrophic. And those prophecies, unfortunately, are coming true now.
Yeah, and there's a moment in your book near the beginning that really struck me, because I think I'm about the same age as you are. A certain commercial that I
you're
remember
30 years
as
old
a child.
Also, no.
Yeah, I wish 30 plus, just double it.
Plus or minus 25. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, okay. So there was this commercial I remember as a kid. And it was this Indian paddling his canoe down this river and looking at all of this pollution in the river. And I knew who the actor was because I'd seen him in lots of films, Iron Eyes Cody. And he has this single tear coming down his cheek. And it says, you know, something like, you know, we were the ones that caused pollution. We can stop it. And, you know, it was very powerful, very moving. And for a lot of us who grew up on that commercial, you know, made us consciously aware of the fact that we were polluting the planet and littering, and you know, littering was bad. And so it seemed like, you know, a really good thing that they did this commercial. And then I read your book and went, oh my God, how I was so manipulated when I was like 9 years old. I am really angry about that. Can you explain that to us, please?
Yeah. You know, I had the same feeling, because I didn't learn about that myself until, I read up on some work that another academic, whose name I'm not going to recall now, who had sort of looked into this and has actually written his own book about sort of the infamous Crying Indian commercial. But he had written an op-ed in the, I believe it was the Chicago Tribune, that I happened to come across some years ago. And it really revolutionized my appreciation of the tactics that have been used for decades now by industry groups to prevent regulations that might, you know, hurt their bottom line. And yeah, I felt the same way. I felt sort of personally violated, like, you know, like my, this part of my youth that had seemed so pure and innocent, that this commercial, which we all, those of us, you know, of our generation who grew up watching, you know, the famous Crying Indian PSA, public service announcement, as it's called, and felt empowered to, you know, to clean up the environment. And it turns out that it was a very, as you say, manipulative public relations ploy by the beverage industry, hatched on Madison Avenue by advertising executives working for Coca-Cola and other beverage industry companies that were very worried about the efforts to pass bottle bills that would place deposits on bottles and cans and get people to pick them up and return them. And we knew, you know, it was known that they work, and it would clean up, you know, the environment. But it would hurt their bottom line, the beverage industry, because they'd have to pay for the processing of those returned bottles and cans. They didn't want to do that. So instead, they funded this massive PR campaign, and they conned, you know, some good folks into it. The Ad Council was the sponsor of those advertisements. And they've done a lot of really important public service announcements over the years. Some green groups, I believe it might have been, is it the Sierra Club or NRDC, I forget, or Environmental Defense, but some of the leading environmental groups at the time actually bought into this as well. They were sort of taken in as we were. They didn't realize that it was in fact a, you know, a ruse. It was a ploy, an effort to deflect attention and interest in passing bottle bills, to deflect attention away from systemic solutions, regulatory solutions to the problem, to individual behavior. It's just a matter of us being better stewards of the environment. If we would just clean up those bottles and cans, we could fix this problem. We don't need any regulation. We don't need a bottle bill. And it was very successful. They ultimately were able to block the passage of bottle bills in most states. And there was never a national bottle bill. And as a result, we have one of the other two major global environmental crises today, the global plastic pollution. And you can thank, at least in part, the beverage industry and the Crying Indian PSA for that problem.
Yeah, I was just dumbstruck when I read that
to
realize how manipulated I had been. And then it also made me realize that this is why so many people are currently being manipulated, especially those people who happen to be what you would call conservative on the spectrum, manipulated to think that, you know, solving the climate crisis is either impossible or bad for business. Those same kinds of arguments are being used about climate change.
Yeah, and even some people on the progressive side of things, you know, there are a lot of, you know, well-meaning, environmentally minded folks out there who really believe that the solution to the climate crisis is going vegan, not eating meat, not flying, not having children, because the same campaign is being run today by the fossil fuel industry. They've taken the Crying Indian playbook, and they've really done such a good job in framing things that way that, look, the New York Times plays into their framing, you know, inadvertently perhaps, but, you know, most of their articles about climate solutions focus on individual behavioral change, diet, travel, etc. and not on the systemic problem of, you know, needing to regulate carbon emissions, needing to provide government incentives for renewable energy. And so that campaign, that playbook has been used very successfully. It's been appropriated by the fossil fuel industry. And just as with the crying Indian PSA, a lot of good folks have been taken in by it.
Yeah, and you make a really interesting point there. There, you even have a chapter called "It's Your Fault."
Right.
You know, it's your fault. It's because you have children. It's because you eat meat, and right. and if you just would stop doing all of those things and have an electric car and solar panels, you can help solve this. And that, as you point out, and as I know, this problem is so big and so global in scale that that's really not a, you know, all those things are good.
Exactly.
You know, there's nothing bad about them.
Exactly.
But
they're not,
you know, I'm not saying people shouldn't have children.
Exactly.
And not enjoy a steak once in a while. But those things, you know, on their own are not enough.
No, they're not. And as you say, they're good reasons to do a lot of those things. And we should encourage people to do them. You know, often they're things that make us healthier. They save us money. They make us feel better. They set a good example for others. Being a good steward of the environment is a good thing to be, and it's helpful, but it's not enough. You know, individual action, voluntary measures by individuals alone are not going to achieve the reductions in carbon emissions that are necessary. And so we need incentives. And, you know, we've long recognized that. We incentivize in market economies. We provide incentives for behavior that we want to see more of, and we provide disincentives for behavior we want to see less of. And that works. That's why we have sin taxes. That's why, you know, we have user fees on certain things. And so there's a long history of using market measures to collectively sort of move us all in the right direction, because while some of us will do it just because it's the right thing, a lot of us do need an incentive, to engage in actions that are better for the collective, that are better for us as a civilization, even if it isn't obvious to us on an individual level.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our visit with Penn State Professor of Atmospheric Science, Michael Mann. His latest book, The New Climate War, is an in-depth look at the politics and science of climate change. Stay with us. And we're back. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Michael Mann, one of the world's leading climate scientists. Mann is the author of a brand new book, The New Climate War, just out from Public Affairs Books. Yeah, and I think of a great example as a child growing up. You know, most of the adults that I saw in my life were cigarette smokers.
Right.
Most of the actors I watched in movies and on television were cigarette smokers.
Right.
And tended to die from being cigarette smokers. Right. And now we live in a society where, you know, people that smoke are, you know, definitely the minority. And the reason for that isn't just, you know, guilt tripping people into, you know, saying you're going to be healthier if you don't smoke. It's been, you know, it's been a big, like you said, a systemic change.
That's right. Yeah, we cracked down, on the tobacco industry, and there was a huge settlement among a number of states' attorneys general that imposed a whole bunch of new constraints and requirements and forced them to pay out a healthy amount of money. And that in concert with messaging, with public messaging, and not allowing them to advertise anymore, it turns out makes a big difference. And now, decades later, I mean, that sort of was happening sort of towards the end of the 1990s, I think there was really a renaissance when it came to our understanding of the tobacco crisis. And here we are two decades later. And as you say, far fewer people, at least in the United States, smoke today. Now, if you go to Europe or elsewhere, it's still a problem. It is a global problem. And to some extent, the tobacco industry sort of, recognize that there were greener pastures elsewhere, Latin America, et cetera. And so the problem hasn't been solved, but here in the United States, we do see the positive consequences of government incentives that, again, work to, in this case, de-incentivize behavior that's bad for us individually and collectively.
Something I found interesting because I was having a kind of a parallel thoughts. You were in Australia last year, right?
In the winter.
And I was watching what was unfolding there with these massive fires and thinking to myself and telling friends and family, I said, you watch, that is going to be us in 6 months, because that is a signature of our changing climate. Yep. And we're going to see the same thing happen here. And this is one of those times I hate being right. I just hate it because this summer was just horrific. It was, not on top of a pandemic. We had these horrible wildfires in the West.
Oh, yeah.
And trapped inside, having to use air filters all the time. And then, going through a fall, frankly, that's been so dry, and everybody, the weather people, the meteorologists on TV coming on saying, it's going to be nice weather tomorrow, and me wanting to strangle them. Just saying, there's nothing nice about this, because it's 75 and sunny and, the sky is blue doesn't make it nice when it's supposed to be cooler and wetter.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I spent a number of years in Northern California. I went to school at UC Berkeley, familiar with Northern California. And you were in the eye of the storm last summer, my friend. It was unfortunately predictable. I spent the beginning of 2020 down in Australia on sabbatical, and I arrived, I hadn't planned to, but I had planned that sabbatical years in advance, but I happened to arrive when they were witnessing this, there's no other way to describe it, apocalyptic sort of event with unprecedented heat and drought coming together to produce these bushfires that blanketed the continent. And I was there in Sydney, inhaling the smoke and unable to see, anything in the distance from the window of my apartment because of the thick blanket of smoke that actually made Sydney, Australia, the city with the worst air quality in the world at that time, far worse than Beijing, for example. And so I saw those factors play out. As it happens, it had a real impact on this book. I was writing this book. That's part of what I was doing during the sabbatical as all of this was unfolding. So it had a real impact on me as I was writing this book. But I recognized that, of course, this is just a glimpse for the rest of the world. What was playing out in Australia was a message to the rest of the world that this is what's coming. And sadly enough, this last summer, as you allude to, I believe it was 5 of the 10 worst wildfires in California history were burning at the same time this summer or early fall.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. Every wind event that would come up, it was just like just cross your fingers and everything, just hope nothing happens. And then sure enough, somebody would do something, or PG&E power lines would, fail. And the next thing you know, you've got another massive conflagration underway. It was the perfect storm of conditions between.
Was it Big Bear? Was that the state forest?
Well, yeah, there's so many, of the national forests were on fire that it's like, you know, the largest one was up near me, the Mendocino complex.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The largest fire in California history, but it was one of many.
I remember specifically because I had hiked through,
Big Sur? You're talking about that area?
In the Santa Cruz, Big Basin, Redwood State Park.
That's
the
line. Yeah.
Where the fire essentially burned through that forest, that Redwood forest. Fortunately, enough of them did survive that I think the forest will survive. But it was a harrowing experience for those of us who had hiked. You know, when I was in Northern California, I had gone on hikes there a number of times. And to imagine that could come so close to being taken away from us by an event like that. Really, it was shocking to me, as well as watching, you know, classes at my alma mater, UC Berkeley, canceled a year ago because of the smoke and the wildfire threat and the blackouts that were resulting.
Yeah. And here's another scary thing is a lot of forest ecologists have been telling me on this show that these massive fires that are burning through and wiping out a lot of our forest lands, those forests aren't necessarily coming back. They're being replaced by montane chaparral, which is more prone to burn. And so it's like we're actually seeing a changing forest ecosystem unfold in this endless loop of feedbacks that are just horrific to watch.
Very well said. It's, you know, it's an example of a physics phenomenon that we sometimes talk about when it comes to nonlinear systems where feedbacks are very strong and they behave in this sort of, they behave in a way that they can be very sensitive to small influences. And so you have these things known as relict forests, which is what you're talking about. And redwood forests are often such relict forces, especially those down in Big Sur at the southern end of the range. Those forests would not be able to grow there now. They're only there because they came into being some time ago and they literally impact their own local climate. The redwoods create because they're able to gather moisture coming off the ocean. They create their own sort of local humid climate. But if you burn them down, it's too dry for redwoods to form. So you don't get those forests back. If you lose them, they're gone in essence forever.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the forces behind all of this. And one of the main characters that keeps popping up throughout your book, and a lot of us are aware of them, are the Koch brothers. Could you tell us about, you know, the efforts that they make to keep this disinformation and deflection campaign going?
Yeah, and to be clear, it's now the Koch brother.
Yes.
Charles Koch, David Koch, passed away a little over a year ago, I believe it was now. And so there's just one of them, but, you know, Charles Koch, but he's continuing the legacy of both his brother and him, of pouring massive amounts of money, millions of dollars into polluting our public discourse over climate change, funding websites and fake news organizations that put out climate change misinformation and disinformation, and sabotaging efforts, not just at the national level, but at the state level to incentivize renewable energy. So for example, they provide a lot of funding to ALEC, which is this group that basically advances pro-industry legislation, pro-fossil fuel industry legislation that blocks efforts to provide incentives at the state level for renewable energy. Fortunately, you know, in California, there's a strong tradition. You have strong leadership and have had for some time. But there are other states where the Koch brothers have been very effective at blocking efforts to introduce clean energy and clean energy alternatives for consumers. And so whether it's the denial of climate change, which they've promoted through their messaging, through their funding, or efforts to block the solution to the climate problem, renewable energy, it's sort of a dual-pronged assault that they've been engaged in. And of course, they have helped elect Republican politicians who have advocated for them and have advanced their agenda of defunding climate research and dismantling environmental protections. We saw a lot of that under the Trump administration. And while so much of the focus was on Donald Trump, let's keep in mind that he, in essence, outsourced his energy and environmental policies to the fossil fuel industry, appointing fossil fuel lobbyists and individuals handpicked by the Koch brothers to run the EPA and the DOE. And we see what the consequences of that were. We lost a lot of ground. We saw a lot of progress that was, lost over the last 4 years because of the dismantling of the efforts by previous administrations, including, of course, the Obama administration, in particular on climate, climate policies that had been instituted during the Obama years, which were eliminated by the Trump administration, aka the fossil fuel industry and the lobbyists that were controlling energy and environmental policies. So the good news, of course, is now we have new leadership with Joe Biden coming in, and based on the folks that he's appointed, we will see a restoration of many of those policies, but to some extent, we're just going to be treading water for a while, just trying to undo the damage that's been done before we can actually make forward progress.
Yeah, I'm curious, what's your take on his appointing John Kerry?
I think that's a masterful appointment for a number of reasons. If you look at John Kerry's history on climate, he was a co-sponsor of one of the major climate bills. It didn't pass the Senate because of the Republican opposition, but he did introduce one of the major climate bills that was brought to the Senate floor about 10 years ago. It would have instituted a cap and trade system to deal with climate pollution. He, Secretary Kerry during the Obama years helped negotiate a bilateral agreement with China, which laid the groundwork for the Paris Agreement, which Kerry helped negotiate for the United States, which was a major achievement, by far the greatest international policy achievement yet when it comes to international action on climate. And he is a diplomat. He is respected as a statesman internationally. He has close relationships with leaders from other countries. I think he's the perfect person to be leading sort of the international climate effort for the Biden administration. Meanwhile, as you know, the domestic effort on climate will be former EPA administrator, and her name is on the tip of my tongue, and I will... I didn't even have to look it up. It came to me. Gina McCarthy. Gina McCarthy, who's a great EPA administrator and understands the domestic politics when it comes to climate legislation and climate action, and I think is the perfect person to be leading the domestic effort. So it's a perfect tag team, with John Kerry leading on the international side and the diplomatic side, and Gina McCarthy leading on the domestic side.
I'd like to go back to talking about those attacks on, it's your fault kind of thing. One of the things that's been going on for quite a long time is to attack somebody like Al Gore for, look at how much energy his house uses, right. or DiCaprio, yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio, because he has, a yacht or goes flying all over. This hypocrisy attack. Could you address that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really where they're literally, it's a three-pronged, it's this effort, a deflection that we talked about before, there's a synergy there with other sort of lines of attack by the inactivists. Because first of all, they want to deflect attention away from systemic solutions towards individual behavior, right? So if you start talking about individuals and their lifestyles, like Leo DiCaprio or Al Gore, then first of all, you have focused attention on individual behavior and you've deflected it away from what we know is the real solution, policy. And you have created division, right? Because if you can get climate advocates arguing with each other about, you know, who's the purest of them all, you know, arguing with each other, accusing each other of lacking, carbon purity in their lifestyle choices, then you divide the movement, right? It's a sort of divide and conquer. And then it's a threefer. It's not just a twofer, but it's a threefer. Because if you can take individuals like Al Gore or Leo DiCaprio, who've been so influential, who have sort of used their platform to advance the climate conversation and to raise awareness about the climate crisis. If you can tar them, discredit them by painting them as hedonists and hypocrites, then you've sort of, in essence, you've disarmed the climate movement. You've taken away some of their most potent leaders and opinion leaders and thought leaders. And so that's why there's such a focus on, you know, Leo DiCaprio's individual behavior and Al Gore's individual behavior. And usually these attacks are dishonest, they're disingenuous because they're misrepresenting the actual facts. For example, with Al Gore, they made a big deal. They actually stole, you know, one of his bills. They were literally, you know, what, going through the trash cans or something, finding one of his old energy bills and showed that, yeah, he uses a lot of energy at this complex that he lives at, but that's where his entire operation, the entire, climate operation that he now runs out of his own residence. And he employs a whole team of people who work there. And so it's really a business. It's not a personal residence. And it was very convenient of them to ignore that fact. And to ignore the fact that he had paid for carbon offsets, you know, to offset, you know, his emissions to the extent it was possible. Or, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, who, you know, is not out there telling other people how to live, you know, what their, you know, how to live, what lifestyle choices to make. And, you know, so it's not hypocritical for him to focus on systemic solutions, because we all know that's where, you know, that's the sweet spot here is policy. And yeah, we should all do what we can in our individual behavior to minimize our footprint with, you know, to the extent that it's possible. If you're an international figure like Leo DiCaprio and you do travel and you're doing important outreach in the process of doing that, then yeah, you're going to incur, a cost in terms of carbon emissions, but you're working towards a system where we hopefully won't have to generate carbon pollution when we travel, when we engage in other activities. And so, you know, it's a really disingenuous effort to tar leading figures in the climate movement as hypocrites, and at the same time you're creating division and you're deflecting attention. So it's a three for one if you're a climate inactivist.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us and we'll continue talking about the science and politics of climate change with Dr. Michael Mann. His latest book, The New Climate War, offers a candid and at times startling look at how politics on both sides of the issue has divided us on something that needs the full force of intergovernmental cooperation to confront an existential crisis. Stay with us.
Thank you.
And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's get back now to our guest, Penn State Professor of Atmospheric Sciences, Dr. Michael Mann. He's the author of the new book, The New Climate War. Well, let's shift our attention to the activists, and especially the young people of today.
Yeah.
And one Greta Thunberg. And the young people of today, because they really have been, you know, they see that the future is not good if things keep going the way they are. Could you address, you know, how do you address that in your book?
Yeah, so, you know, I end on a cautiously optimistic note. And it's genuine, because despite all the challenges, and they're numerous, you've read the book, you know, there are a lot of challenges that we face. It's still an uphill battle. But that having been said, there are a number of threads that have come together, I think, to create an unprecedented opportunity for change, for action. One of them I sort of had to predict, because the book went to press in August and comes out this January. So I had to sort of anticipate where we would be on the other side of an upcoming election. And where I anticipated we would be is where we pretty much are, that there's a favorable shift in the political winds, and that's in the form of a president, Biden, who supports climate action, but where we still have, for example, a divided Congress, which will introduces a challenge when it comes, for example, to getting climate legislation passed, a climate bill passed. You know, we're unlikely to see anything that looks like a Green New Deal pass this next Congress. And so a lot of the focus will be on executive action. So, you know, it's a favorable shift in the winds, but maybe not as favorable as one might hope. But things are more favorable politically. There is, you know, this awareness of the climate crisis now, because it's become so clear to the person on the street. It just isn't credible to say that something isn't happening. And we're seeing the damaging impacts of climate change play out in real time. So there's this new level of public awareness of the threat of climate change. There's a pandemic, of course, that has sort of focused attention on the immediate crisis that we face, the health crisis of the pandemic, but it's also created a larger conversation about sort of, the sustainability. Can we continue to live like this and be sustainable and live sustainably on this planet? And I think we're having some deeper conversations now about sort of the precariousness of our place on this planet, given all of the crises we face, the threats we face, whether it be a pandemic or the larger crisis that looms in the background, which is the climate crisis. And finally, the last piece in that, those threads that have come together to give us an unprecedented opportunity for change is the youth climate movement. It's really, I think, recentered this entire conversation where it needed to be. For too long, this was about science and politics and economics and policy, when more than anything else, this is an issue of ethics, of intergenerational ethics, our obligation not to leave behind a degraded planet for our children and grandchildren. And Greta Thunberg and the other youth climate protesters and demonstrators and strikers have really raised international awareness, and they've refocused the conversation on this basic issue of preserving this planet for future generations, the ethical imperative of us doing that, and not making irreversible decisions now that will impair the planet for others in the future.
Yeah, and those forces that we've been talking about throughout the show, and you talk about throughout your book, they even came up with an anti-Greta, didn't they? Or tried to.
Yeah, it's just remarkable the depths to which the climate denial and delay movement is willing to sink in their efforts to block action. They literally did seek out a young woman who was a climate change denier and tried to sort of promote her and get the press to somehow focus equally on her, as if there is some duality here. There's the Greta and the anti-Greta, and, you know, we should listen to them both, or, you know, who knows what the underlying principle is. But it was a distraction, right? Mm-hmm. Because Greta and the youth climate protesters have been so effective in changing the conversation. The inactivists were desperate to try to change the conversation, and so desperate that they even turned to, you know, what was just so transparently a ploy to introduce a so-called anti-Greta.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting to me, in reading your book and thinking about this the last few days before I knew I was going to talk to you, I can't help but think, excuse me, I can't help but think about the past, that we once lived in a society where everything was horse-drawn carriages and people rode horses. That was the primary method of transportation. And then the automobile starts to come along and you've got these people saying, well, I don't trust those things. Just let me keep my horse. And of course, you know, after a while, they evolved to become, you know, this society that loves the automobile and loves their V8 engines and that kind of thing. And now we need to, you know, do the same thing and shift to, you know, you can have your car. It's just going to be an electric guitar, or electric guitar would be
electric
nice.
Electric guitar in your electric
plug
car.
It, plug it in, plug it into the wall with your car. Yeah. With your hybrid. And go to a fully electrified transportation system with renewables. That this is something that we can do. We're smart enough to be able to achieve this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so exciting, too. Just yesterday, I was reading an article about wireless charging stations. I don't know if you've come across this, but uses a alternating magnetic field so mm-hmm. that you just park in a space and your car will recharge while you've parked. You don't have to plug anything in. It's really remarkable. And it's exciting, right? I mean, this is like the stuff out of science fiction, and it's coming to life, and it's very exciting. You know, there's a saying, and I forget the precise origins of it, but it really captures the essence of what we're talking about here. You know, the Stone Age didn't end for want of stones, and the fossil fuel age won't end for want of fossil fuels. It won't end because we've literally run out of fossil fuels. It'll end, and it is ending, because we've found something better. And I think that that's the wonder of the time that we're living in, that we get to experience that. And it's exciting. So it doesn't have to be depressing. You know, it's not doom and gloom. There's real opportunity. There's opportunity for us to live in a better world with better technology and greener technology and be happier and thrive without degrading the planet for us and for other creatures and for future generations.
Yeah. And it's so interesting, you know, thinking about that. And before I let you go, I'm wondering, did you happen to see there was a NOVA program on just recently called Cooling the Earth? Did you happen to catch that?
I did see it.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm just curious, what was your take on that? Because they did this whole hour on, you know, all these geoengineering ideas. Right. Give us your overview of that point of view, that, you know, we're going to have to do all these drastic things to cool the planet while we transition away from a carbon economy.
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. You know, I actually did see that that documentary. In fact, I have some colleagues who were in it and did a good job, you know, given the role that they were asked to play. But the overall framing of the documentary to me was a bit troubling. And at the end, you know, the documentary, you may remember this, up on the screen comes the acknowledgement of funding. And NOVA has historically derived a lot of funding from...
Is there a K word there? Did I see a K in that?
Yep.
K-O-C-H?
I think
I saw
Koch.
That. Yep.
Thanks to David H. Koch for the funding that helped So, I mean, there it is. And that messaging is very convenient for the inactivists. False solutions, right? Anything but decarbonizing. We don't want to decarbonize. We don't want to get off fossil fuels. We want to continue to extract and sell and profit from fossil fuels. So how about we continue to burn carbon, but we cool the planet off by shooting particles into the stratosphere or dumping iron into the ocean or any number of schemes that frankly seem like the things of science fiction, the stuff of science fiction. And and thereby engage in this massive intervention, global scale, planetary scale intervention with a system we don't understand completely. What could possibly go wrong is sort of the requisite question to ask there, the rhetorical question to ask there, because we know the answer. A lot could go wrong. And it can be used as a crutch, right? And it is being used as a crutch for not doing the hard but necessary work to decarbonize human civilization. This idea, well, we don't have to, or at least, and here's where it gets a little, here's where the rubber hits the road in my view, because what the proponents will say, well, you know, it buys us time. Well, why does it buy us time? It only buys us time if we don't work hard enough to decarbonize our economy. And so what it really means is it provides time for fossil fuel interests and those who benefit from them to continue to profit as we slowly decarbonize and transition into a clean energy economy. The reality is that the smartest solution, the safest solution, is simply to stop doing what we know is damaging the planet, to get off fossil fuels as quickly as possible. And we have the solution. You know, we don't need a miracle. Bill Gates has a book coming out on climate early next year. And, you know, he has funded geoengineering research for a number of years. And he has said things like, we need a miracle to solve this problem. Well, no, Bill Gates, we don't need a miracle. It's already there. It's called the sun. It's called wind, geothermal. It's there. We just need incentives that scale that up quickly so that we can decarbonize human civilization. And frankly, there are a lot of false solutions being put out there. Carbon capture and sequestration, to some extent, is used that way. But geoengineering is certainly used as, by some at least, as an excuse for not decarbonizing as quickly as we have to.
Well, you know, and on that note, I'd like to add that, because we're out of time, but it makes me think about, you know, everybody worries about people's jobs and everything. There are going to be jobs to be had with a new type of economy. And it's the same, you know, okay, if you were an oil worker or you worked in the petrochemical industry, you may have to shift to a different line of work. Just like, you know what, there aren't a whole lot of farriers out there now that make a living shoeing horses.
Or whale oil, you know, there's no whale oil industry.
Or whale oil industry. We have moved on, and it's time to move on again. Michael Mann, thanks so much for not only writing this book, but talking to us today about it. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. And thanks for your work as a climate scientist and somebody that's making these issues clearer to us, because Lord knows there's a lot of forces out there trying to obfuscate.
Well, I want to thank you, Dave, for helping, you know, get that information out to the public.